This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It is gorgeous. The weather is gorgeous today. It's what, the 17th of July? Normally, on the 17th of July, we are just sweating like crazy, and I'm wondering if I should get my air conditioner fixed. But, you know, today, well, yesterday, too, and I think tomorrow as well, it's what? It's like, in July, it's 73 degrees. It's normally like 95. So, I don't know. They say it's not the polar vortex, but it's kind of something like the polar vortex. So, I can't complain about the summer. I hope this doesn't mean that the winter is going to be as bad as the last winter we had. But, yeah, so, whatever. Just enjoy it while we can. And if it's cold this winter, well, we'll suffer our way through that and we'll be all right. It's been a good week. I've been plowing along trying to get a design document done on the reporting sub-project, which is the first project that we're going to do for this financial redesign initiative that I'm working on for my major client. That seems to be going fine. I wish I was a little farther ahead than I am, but I had to peel off and do some other things, and so a little bit behind, but I think we're going to be fine. I need to land this at the end of the month, and I think it's going to be okay. So that's all going fine. Had some nice conversations with friends this week. The topic of conversation this week was legalization of drugs, because I think in this new book I'm working on, Windfall Broadcast, I think there's some drug stuff in it somewhere, and so just been chatting with a few friends about that, you know, trying to figure out angles on that. It's pretty interesting. I personally have come to a kind of a fairly radical spot in that I really believe in free will. And I understand that some people are worried about the fabric of society, but I think if prohibition showed us anything, it's that people are going to do what they want to do. And you can just end up criminalizing a bunch of stuff and end up spending a lot of money. And just this last week, I had seen that was somebody that was waving at somebody else. Just last week, I had seen an article about how much money is expended every year on the war against drugs and how many drug users there are in this country estimated. And basically, the number of drug users in this country estimated is the same as it's been for decades, except that we just keep spending more and more and more and more money to fight it, and we're not getting anywhere. So, of course, that leads me to a certain conclusion. But then where do you stop? You know, that's what the discussions have been about. You know, okay, so marijuana appears that it's going to get legalized. Fine. Now, you know, cocaine, is that next? Meth, you know, heroin, crocodile, is that the new one? I mean, you know, heard about another type of meth today. I was talking to a friend called Shake and Bake. Basically, you mix up this brew in this bottle, and if you shake it too much, it blows up. Oh, man. And he was talking about, you know, people in Walmart getting tackled because they were carrying around Shake and Bake in their back pocket. And then said you mix this up and then you drink it. And I feel bad for people. You know, and what are we going to do with that? Obviously, we don't want to legalize that. It's really interesting. It's just really interesting in the context of society. And how does society protect itself and ensure the common good and promote the common good? It's very interesting. It's very interesting. So I'm just kind of mulling a bunch of that stuff. And sometimes I don't even know what I'm going to propose as a solution as I'm writing books and stuff until I get to that section, and then I start writing and it just starts coming out of my fingertips, and it's like, hey, oh wait. So that's one of the fun parts about writing these books, is because I get to think about this stuff and then try to make some sense of it. And in the process of trying to make some sense of it, say, well, this, is something I think about, and what do you guys think about this? So it's fun. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. Anyways, so this week that's all gone well. I've got, as I said, a whole list of things I was going to talk about. And I'm basically just running my way down things that I've found interesting. One of the things I found interesting a couple of weeks ago was I watched a TED Talk called Why We Should Trust Scientists. I thought, okay, well, that's pretty interesting. Just a bit of background, in case you haven't listened to many of the podcasts. I believe in science. I think science is a great thing. I respect scientists in what they do. I think science should always be couched in terms of it is the glory of God to hide a thing and the glory of kings to seek it out, which is a proverb in the book of Proverbs. I think it's in the book of Proverbs. And that's, I think, God has given us inquisitive minds, and he's given us the ability to investigate and figure out how things work, and I think that's part of the human experience, and I think it's valuable, and I think it's great. So I am definitely not against science. By the same token, I do think that there are forces at work in this world that lead us in our investigations to be biased in particular directions. And as much as scientists might not want to admit that they are biased and that they have belief systems, the fact of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned, they do. And they reject certain things simply on the basis of they don't want them to be that way. And so that's fine. But as I was listening to this TED Talk, I thought the lady that was doing this TED Talk had some very interesting things to say about science and what we perceive of the value of science. And it was interesting. I thought it was interesting where she ended up. So she started off with the fact that every day we face a lot of issues where, we'd like to be able to rely on somebody having an answer for us. She said, so we have scientists that are telling us things. She said, but how do we know if they're right? How do we know if vaccines are really safe or not? How do we know whether global warming is happening or not? How do we know whether evolution actually occurred or not? And she said, how do we know if we should believe in that? And she said, scientists immediately will kind of react to that question because they don't like to talk about science in terms of belief. They just like to talk about it in terms of fact. These are facts, and science and faith don't really have anything to do with each other, and what we do as scientists is just the facts, and ta-da. Okay, well, as she started moving down through this, I thought she had some very, very interesting points, which kind of illustrated that, in fact, it's not as cut-and-dried facts as maybe scientists would like to purport. Now, pausing here, having my own commentary, why would scientists want to purport what they're doing is absolutely factual and true when in fact there have been examples of where it isn't? And so there was a certain belief component. Why would scientists be loathed to admit that there is this belief component when you can clearly look back in the history of science and see when people were reaching conclusions that were based on false beliefs? Well, my interpretation would be the reason that we have this appeal to it being facts, the reason that we have this appeal to a situation where we're not allowed to question things, that we're just supposed to take these facts at face value, is because scientists like to be the authorities. And when they do their scientists, then they want to be able to put their finger on it and say, see, it has to be true because I did the experiments. Ta-da, it has to be true. And the lady, as she was talking, actually ended up with some interesting reasons why it doesn't have to be true. And so we'll get to those in just a second. She did mention at the beginning of her talk, which was, you know, very good. She said that, you know, really, we can't judge scientific claims for ourselves in most cases. And she said even inside the environment of being a scientist, inside the scientific community, people can't. She said you aren't necessarily going to find a geologist who's going to tell you whether a vaccine is safe, because they're all different specialities. So how do scientists believe each other's claims? And why should we, as the general populace, believe those claims? So she started going through some of the traditional reasons that are given for us to believe these claims. She said, for instance, she said in school we're taught that the reason we should believe in science is because scientists follow the scientific method. And because they follow this method, it guarantees the truth of their claims. And she said the name for the method is the hypothetical deductive method. And she said in this method, scientists make hypotheses and then they go out into the world, they test those hypotheses, and they determine whether the hypothesis is true and supported by test data. This is the standard scientific method. And she said there have been some wonderful successes through this. Einstein proposed this crazy notion that space-time wasn't just an empty void, but it actually had a fabric. And in fact, gravity could bend that fabric, and in the bending of that fabric, light could actually be bent. You know, when he first proposed this, people were looking at him cross-eyed, but this was his hypothesis, and as part of that hypothesis, he purported that light would in fact be bent, and if we looked at the sun and we looked at the stars shining near the sun, that we would actually see that the starlight of stars that were slightly behind the sun was being bent around it so that we could see them. And in fact, they went out, they checked this, lo and behold it was, and everybody said, oh, well, this hypothesis must be true. Okay, so the other thing that this scientific model is referred to, and I didn't know this, I thought this was interesting, is the deductive nomological model. Nomological model. And she said that's because academics like to make things complicated. She said, but what the essence of the deductive nomological model is that it has to do with laws. She said because nomological means having to do with laws. So what we're really saying is that this scientific method is just like a law in the universe. That if you can prove something with the scientific method, that you have discovered something that has to be true. She said, like Einstein's famous equations, E equals MC squared. So we've deduced this, we've tested it, it has to be true. She went on to say, she said, well, as it turns out, though, she said there are some problems with the model. And she said the main problem is that it's wrong. It's just not true. Which, of course, everybody laughed, but then she went on to explain how it's not true. She said it's wrong for a number of reasons. She said, first of all, there is a logical reason. And she said, logically, it's called the problem of the fallacy affirming the consequent. And she said, that's just another fancy way for saying that false theories can make true predictions. She said, just because a prediction comes true doesn't logically prove that the theory is correct. And she says, an example, you can go back to the Ptolemaic model, where the Earth is in the center, and it was believed for many, many years by smart people. And she said, why? Because it made a lot of predictions, and they came true. She said, in fact, she said, there's some things about the Ptolemaic model, she said, at first, that made better predictions than the Copernican model that followed it. So here you have the scientific method. We make a hypothesis. Everything travels around the Earth. We are at the center of the universe. And from that, we make predictions. Those predictions turn out to be true, except it's not a law that the Earth is at the center of the universe. In fact, it's completely wrong. And yet the scientific method in part supported it for a time. She said the second problem that you have is a practical problem. And she said we call that the problem of auxiliary hypothesis. She said the auxiliary hypothesis are assumptions that scientists are making that they may or may not even be aware that they are making. She said this showed up when Copernicus said that, well, the Earth actually is traveling around the Sun. Some people who heard this theory said, well, fine. If the Earth is traveling around the Sun, then what we should see is we should see parallax. We should see the relative positions of stars change through the year, because in July, the Earth is on one side of the Sun, and in December, it's on the other side of the Sun. Therefore, if we look at a set of stars that is perpendicular to us, what should happen as we examine those stars against the star background, since some of those stars are closer and some of them are farther, we should see those stars shifting against their background. And so they said, great, let's try it. And they tried it, and there was no shift. And some people said, the Copernicus model that says that the Earth is moving around the Sun is wrong. Because they made a hypothesis, they went out, they checked the data, and the data said that the hypothesis was not true. The problem was, at this time, the astronomers were making two auxiliary hypotheses that they were not aware of, both of which we now know were incorrect. One was they made an assumption about the size of the Earth's orbit, and two, they were assuming that the Earth's orbit was relatively large compared to the distance to the stars. So from their calculations, they expected to see parallax, and they didn't see it. What was really true was the stars are a fur piece out there. They're a long, long way away compared to the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. And so there is a minuscule parallax effect, and you need really sensitive instruments. And so you had not only a couple of different hypotheses that were wrong, you had another problem in that the scientists assumed that their instruments would be able to detect the parallax when in fact they didn't. Okay. So she said the third problem is the factual problem. And she said the fact is that a lot of the science that is done doesn't fit the textbook model. It does not fit the deductive reasoning model. You can't make a hypothesis about it and go out and just test it in the world. And evolution is the classic example that's given of this. You can't test evolution. You can't go out and put it in a petri dish and say, okay, this is how life got started. And, oh, hey, look, life started. Ta-da, yay. You can't do that because there are things that happened in the past that are irreproducible. And so what you're left with is simply gathering a bunch of deductions, which is what Darwin did, and then inducing a theory out of that, inductive science. She said also that scientists now participate in modeling. They look at something in nature and they say, oh, that kind of looks like this. And then they go build models in the computer and they simulate things in the computer. And then if the model matches what they see, then they say, oh, this is probably what's going on. Okay, well, that's only as good as your models are. Now, the models just keep getting bigger because now we can do them digitally, yada, 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 yada. She said all that to say, one moment, I'm going to get my mail. She said all that to say that scientists, in fact, use a lot of different methods, that there is no one method that, in fact, the scientists use, and therefore they can claim that this method is very good at producing laws, so everything that we say must be a law and must be true. She said, in fact, scientists use many, many different methods and try to figure out what's true based on those methods. You know, basically, anything goes if it will help you get closer to what you think is going on. And in fact, one guy said, if you press me to say what is the method of science, I would have to say anything goes. Okay, so she said, if that's true, then now we get back to our original question of, if scientists don't use a single method, so then how in the world do we decide what's true and what's not true? In essence, how do we decide what we're going to believe? And this is where, you know, it starts, well, the rest of it was interesting to me, but this is where she ended up in a place that I thought was pretty interesting. She said, well, what it comes down to is that the scientists collect evidence in lots of different ways, and it all gets subjected to scrutiny. And she said, we basically have an organized skepticism. She said, but it's not just a bunch of people off the street. She said, these people are, you know, highly disciplined, they're nerds. And she said, you don't really get judged by a jury of your peers. You get judged by a jury of nerds. Now, she did go on to say that this jury, she said, they don't necessarily just come back with a thumbs up and thumbs down. She said, you've got this jury of men and women with PhDs, and unlike a conventional jury, which only has two choices, the scientific jury actually has a number of choices. Scientists can say, yes, something is true. They can say, no, it's false. Or they can say, well, it might be true, but we need to work on it more and collect some more evidence. Or they might say, it might be true, but we don't know how to answer the question, and we're willing to put it aside, and maybe we'll come back to it later. It is intractable. So then she brought up something more. She said, but this leads us to one final problem. If science is what science says it is, then isn't, you know, because it's just, it does, it just decides what it is. She said, then isn't that just an appeal to authority? It's right because I said so. She said, and aren't we all taught in school that the appeal to authority is a logical fallacy? And she said, it is. She said that science actually is an appeal to authority. She said, but it's not the authority of an individual, no matter how smart that individual is, like Plato or Socrates or Einstein. It's the appeal to the authority of a collective community. You can think of it as a kind of wisdom of the crowd, but it's a very special kind of crowd. Science does appeal to authority, but it's not based on an individual, no matter how smart that individual may be. It's based on a collective wisdom, the collective knowledge, and the collective work of all the scientists who've worked on a particular problem. Now, what's interesting to me from that is that people would say, well, and those people, everyone's going to have different viewpoints. And so, you know, they're all going to be skeptical in different ways, so this will even everything out. And my response is, yeah, or there is a certain mindset that brings people to be scientists. That mindset is groomed and cultured, that they are all meant to be skeptics, that they are all trained to treat anything that they can't feel, see, touch as really not worthy of existing. And I would maintain that all of those things move you in a certain direction, even though there are many good scientists who believe in a designer, that those things do move you in a certain direction to look past potential solutions and to disavow the possibility that there might be a designer out there. But, you know, that's okay. That's neither here nor there because, as I'm fond of saying, we have three waves here and we're in the middle of the second wave now where it just gets to be more and more ridiculous that everything is so finely balanced and everybody gets floundering around for a solution. But eventually, I think the third wave is going to get here and people are going to throw up their hands and go, ah, yeah, okay. There's got to be something out there. So anyways, the upshot of all of this is that she then went from theoretical science to figure it, to give an example of why we should trust science, all the way down to something very, very practical, and that is technology. She said, the modern automobile is a product of the collected work and will and wisdom and experience of every man and woman who has ever worked on a car, and the reliability of the technology is the result of that accumulated effort. We benefit not just from the genius of Benz and Fords and Musk, but from the collective intelligence and hard work of all the people who have worked on any modern car. Our basis for trust in science is actually the same as our basis for trust in technology, and the same as our basis for trust in anything, namely experience. Okay, well, you know, that's fine. And really, I think that's honest. That at the bottom of it all, we have this experience with science, and it's worked out pretty well, and so we're willing to give science the benefit of the doubt until another experience comes along and proves them wrong. Now, what's very interesting about that is you would think that scientists who live within this crucible of realizing that there may be logical fallacies that they're overlooking, that there may be auxiliary hypothesis that they're not issue, that they're not factoring in, you know, that their deductive scientific method that they trump is not necessarily what they use. You would think that in the mix of all that, you would end up with scientists who are in fact very humble and very compassionate and generous about what they're doing, who would say, you know, this is the way it appears to look right now. But, you know, we may wake up tomorrow and find more evidence and find more things. We may have new experiences that lead us in a different direction. You would think that embracing the truth of science, that it is not a whole set of laws, that it is in fact a continuous learning experience, that you would think that all of that would engender a very humble, filled with humility attitude. And every time that when you came up against a scientist and discussed anything a scientist, what you would really get from them is, these are the things that I've been privileged to learn so far, I think. There may be some problems with this, but I think right now I'm really excited about, isn't this fascinating? You would think that would be the type of attitude that scientists would have. Not, I'm right, you're wrong because you don't know anything and I'm a scientist. But of course, what we do find many times is more the I'm right, you're wrong, and I know because I'm a scientist attitude. And where does that attitude come from? Well, that comes from flesh. And in my little world and in my little way of analyzing things, if it's coming from the flesh, it means the flesh is probably hiding something so that it can create a greater environment of destruction. When that thing which it's hiding is actually revealed and the scientist is embarrassed. So I say all that to say, I do love science and I do love technology, and I think it's wonderful that people have been able to discover so many things like digital recorders that allowed me to record and freeze a moment in time that will hopefully be listened to by my grandkids at some point and their kids at some point in the future. But I also recognize that science is something that is ever expanding and ever modifying and ever growing and ever learning. And so I really don't get too caught up and worried when a scientist makes some great claim like, the universe doesn't need a God. There is no God out here. We have not found him, blah, 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 blah. I just smile and think, yeah, just wait. Just wait. Everything will become clear eventually. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.